This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, Betsy Nash, who we call the Grape Nut, will learn some useful wine terms from a local sommelier.
The way that they describe wine, sometimes it can be very confusing. Like, do they actually put the black pepper and leather, and how do they get the smoke in there?
Also, you'll hear from Orchestra Novo's musical director, Michael Novak, and musician Inga Swearingen.
It's thrilling to hear something that you wrote for guitar and voice to be filled out into full orchestra.
Swearingen will be presenting her songs accompanied by Orchestra Novo this Saturday. These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday. It's November 15th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. We'll start with Agenda Breakdown with Kim Bischoff. In this episode, you'll get an update on the local redistricting process.
Welcome to Agenda Breakdown, a podcast that explores how cities make decisions and how you can have a say. I'm Kim Bischoff, and today we're going to talk about redistricting. What the heck is it, and why should we care? There's been a lot of chatter lately about redistricting, which is a process that Slo County is going through right now. If you heard about it and your eyes glazed over, don't worry, you're not alone. Instead of assuming that we're all familiar with the concept, I thought I would take a step back today and talk about what it means and how it works. Here to help me with that is Cal Poly political science professor Michael Latner. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the basics. We all know that counties are made up of cities and that those cities are governed by city councils and mayors, but counties are also divided into districts. Michael, can you tell us what districts are?
Yeah, so in California, we have a lot of local government. As you mentioned, we have city councils and their executives or mayors. We also have school board districts. We have water districts. We have all kinds of special districts. And one of the basic units of California government is the county. And indeed, most of the state's services are actually provided by county governments. And by state law, county governments are governed by a board of supervisors of five supervisors. That's true for San Luis Obispo. It's even true for big LA County. So you've got five supervisors there. The only county that doesn't have a board of supervisors in the way that we do is San Francisco, which is a combination county-city government. Why do we have districts? It's a really great question because it begs the question, why do we have to redistrict? We have the board of supervisors that consists of five members, and the state constitution determines that we elect them through single seat districts. So with five members, we have five districts. And so we have to carve the county up into five single seat districts every 10 years. The idea behind single seat districts is to ensure some sort of geographic representation. And what that really comes from is the, frankly, rather antiquated notion that communities are tied to geography, right? To the extent that certain types of people or certain types of industries and communities are tied to geography, the idea of geographic representation is that you'll capture that representation by carving out a district to represent it. It's not, in fact, actually the case because some communities are represented geographically, but of course, some communities aren't. Some communities don't have a geographic basis in representation. And so it's just sort of the system that we've been left with, and it's the system that the state constitution mandates. And so every 10 years, we have to determine new district boundaries.
Have we always had those geographic districts, or was there ever a time when we just had five supervisors and equal representation there?
You know, it's a great question, and I don't actually know the answer to that. The state constitution changes quite a bit in California. As you know, we have the initiative and the referendum and all that. I mean, as long as I can remember, we have had five supervisors elected through single seat districts, but it's an interesting historical question.
So every 10 years, the boundaries of the districts get redrawn. What does that process typically look like in our county?
So that's sort of what one might think of as a disadvantage of single seat districts is that they have to be redrawn as the population changes. And so every 10 years, when we have a census, the decennial census provides us with population estimates. And because we have what has been deemed the one person, one vote rule, every 10 years, districts from all the way from Congress down to the local school board have to be redrawn to be roughly proportionate in population. That is, the districts need to be equally populated. And the reason for that is because if you have unequally populated districts, you have something called malapportionment, which means that people in less populated districts have more voting power, right? And we can think of this intuitively in terms of the U.S. Senate, right? Which is a chamber that is malapportioned by design. So Wyoming gets its two representatives with, you know, 500,000 people, and California gets two representatives with 40 million people. We get screwed in that deal. For the county of San Luis Obispo, like many other counties in many other states, it is actually the elected officials themselves that do the redistricting. And so it's the county board of supervisors that's responsible for drawing up new maps, for using the census data and other political data in order to design their own districts. And you might immediately ask yourself, well, why do we allow elected representatives to choose their own voters as opposed to voters choosing representatives? Well, that's one of the downsides of the single-seat district method. And the state actually has addressed this issue by creating an independent redistricting commission. And so there's this really kind of cool deliberative process whereby we create this commission in the state every 10 years, and then it's the commission that chooses the boundaries. Similarly, our neighbors to the south in Santa Barbara, they have an independent redistricting commission. Some cities, the city of Long Beach, for example, uses an independent redistricting commission, and about a dozen of them exist at the local level in California. But in San Luis Obispo, it's the Board of Supervisors that's ultimately has the authority to select the map.
You're listening to Agenda Breakdown. I'm Kim Bischoff, and I'm here today with Cal Poly political science professor Michael Lattner. What does that mean in terms of how those boundaries affect us as individual citizens?
Well, it actually affects us in pretty profound ways. And I'll just give you two examples. The thing about single seat districts is that only one representative wins 100% of the representation. By definition, you're going to have people who are losers in elections. Their candidate doesn't win, their party doesn't win. And so they don't have any representation within their district. Now, if we think about representation countywide, then, you know, we may or we may not get a proportional allocation of seats. And as long as a majority of voters are determining a majority of the seats on the board, we would consider that fair from the perspective of democratic theory. But the basic idea behind the principle of political equality is that everyone's vote counts the same. The seats should be proportional to vote shares, right? I mean, that's a basic rule of political equality. So the drawing of the boundaries is important because it determines representation. And the way that those boundaries are drawn, again, because they're single seat districts, can greatly affect the type of representation you get, right? So San Luis Obispo is a fairly competitive county, right? I mean, it's leaned Democrat over the last decade or so. But if things were proportional, it would be a roughly 3-2 county, right? And occasionally Republicans would win a majority if they do very well within the county. The downside with the single seat district method is, you know, if we maximize competition so that every district is 51-49, then we could end up with 5 Republicans and no Democrats, or 5 Democrats and no Republicans, right? Just based on a slight vote swing. And so that's the other way that these district boundaries really matter, right? You can make districts very competitive. You can make districts very uncompetitive. We can draw them in such a way so that incumbents are protected. And so that even if there is a big swing in vote share, there's no change in terms of who's sitting on the board. And so these boundaries really matter in a profound way in terms of engendering representation, but then also in terms of public policy. Right. So one of the things that my research has shown nationally, looking at state legislatures, is that bias in state legislatures, when they're not representative of the public, that has a really big effect on the types of public policies that are passed. And not so surprisingly, those who are underrepresented in state legislatures tend to get the burden of bad policy choices. So when we're looking at public health policy or environmental policy and the like, groups that are underrepresented in state legislatures don't have their interests represented, and the consequences are really life and death in terms of looking at health outcomes across states, looking at COVID responses, for example, during the pandemic, the extent to which states made it easier or more difficult to vote during the pandemic. So these have big long-term policy consequences as well.
Is an independent commission on the table for Slo County, or has that ship sailed?
It has sailed for this round of redistricting. So this is something that I think voting rights groups, the League of Women Voters, other groups in the county, bipartisan groups, you know, Republicans and Democrats support fair districts. I mean, I don't think anyone openly supports gerrymandering. And so this is something that the public needs to get behind, and it's something that we can put into place for the next decennial census.
What are the supervisors going to decide at the November 19th meeting?
They're going to select a map for the county staff to follow up on and look to adopt. And so this is going to be a chance, even though, you know, we don't have an independent redistricting commission, that doesn't mean that the public can't be involved. One of the things that's really changed in this redistricting cycle is that the technology to draw maps and to analyze census and election data has really been democratized. And what I mean by that is that there is now online software and there are free programs and free storage capacity and computational power so that average citizens can draw their own maps. They can look at the consequences of boundaries and they can present evidence to the board of what kind of representation they would like to see on the board. And they can help ensure or at least pressure the Board of Supervisors to adopt a fair districting plan that doesn't discriminate against any voters. And so it's really important that people show up to these meetings to defend not just their own community interests, but to ensure that every voter in San Luis Obispo County has a fair and equal chance at determining who sits on the board.
Thank you so much, Michael. This has been an incredibly helpful conversation. I appreciate your time.
You bet. Well, thanks for having me. And I'm really glad that you're focusing on this story.
That brings us to the part of the show where I tell you how to make your voice heard, the action item. Today's action item actually has two parts. First, go to the county's webpage and take a look at the redistricting maps. Find out which district you're in and how the boundaries would change according to those proposed maps. Next, share your thoughts with the county supervisors by calling into the meeting or emailing them at redistricting@co.slo.ca.us. I will post that and links in the show notes and on our Instagram page at Agenda Breakdown. Was produced by Francisco Martinez with original music by Wes Bischoff. That's all for now. See you next time on Agenda Breakdown.
Up next, The Grape Nut. Betsy Nash sat down with local sommelier Jenna Congdon.
Well, hello, all my grape nuts. Today we're going to talk about some of the terms that we have not defined yet or have not defined thoroughly enough, in my estimation, in the first two episodes of The Grape Nut. We're going to talk with a sommelier because, you know, you got to go to the person who knows what they're talking about. And we're going to do this at the Wine Sneak. If you haven't heard about the Wine Sneak, it's right across the street from the airport in San Luis. It's run by Lissa and Ash. It's a wine bar, and we are in what room are we in?
The reserve room.
The reserve room, which is packed with wine bottles, and it looks just like it does out there in the major part of the wine bar, because they have a million bottles of wine in here. And it's always been Ash and Lissa who I've gone to when I say, okay, we're gonna cook chicken parmesan tonight. What wine do I have? They just tell me what wine to buy, and I don't want to do that anymore. I want to learn about wines. So that's my long introduction to Jenna Congdon, who is a sommelier here in San Luis. And my wine buddy and I, Jim D'Antona, took a wine class from you here a while ago, a couple of years ago.
Did we do French wine?
I think we did how to define things we're smelling.
Oh, yeah, sensory evaluation.
Thank you.
Oh, that's one of my favorite ones. Well,
as you can see, I call it things we're smelling, and Jenna calls it sensory evaluation. So that is that's why I'm talking to you today. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Tell me how you got into this, because I know you grew up in Santa Cruz. You came down to go to Poly, and like me, you found a way to stay here.
Yeah.
My route was through title insurance and playing volleyball on the beach, and yours led you to wine?
It did. Yeah, I went to Cal Poly, and yeah, I didn't want to leave the area, and found my way at Tally Vineyards, which was my first wine job in 2003. Well, so I worked for them for a number of years. And then we moved to Paso Robles. I didn't want to commute all the way to Oro Grande every day.
Yeah.
And so I did the very ironic step and became a wine rep and basically drove my car all day, every day.
So how did you get your first job at a winery? Had you always been interested in wine?
I was actually a preschool teacher.
Oh.
And
so you drank wine after school.
Yeah, exactly, to cope. And I was also tending bar and working at restaurants, which you would think that's how I would get into wine. But Instead, I was one of the parents at the preschool, was a tasting room manager at Tally Vineyards.
Oh, okay.
And they had an opening in the tasting room. And she asked me if I liked wine, knew anything about wine. I said, I know a little, you know, through the restaurant world. And my dad was a big wino. So
Wine drinker. He's going to listen to this.
He was a connoisseur.
Okay, good.
So yeah, I started there and I loved it so much. They had a full-time opening and I decided to forgo the education path that I was on and instead find my way into wine, which now I'm kind of a wine educator. So I still do some sort of education, I
right.
suppose.
So you got into sales. Why did you decide you wanted to study to be a sommelier? Because isn't that a lot of studying?
It is. And actually, it took me a long time to get to that road. I didn't think I really needed it because I was the wine rep. The person who I'm talking to every day, the wine buyer, is really supposed to be the expert.
Gotcha.
You know, with certifications, not necessarily me. But I took a little side road and opened a little wine shop for Kimberly Walker from Granada Hotel and Bistro.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Called Station. And it was very based in imports.
Was that the one that was down on Hygera?
It was.
In an old gas station.
I think the corner of Hygera and Walker Street. And yeah, I think it's going to be Ascendo Coffee now.
Okay.
We did a lot with imports. That was our primary focus.
Oh.
Was old world wines, imported wines, non-local.
Oh.
And so because of that, we did a lot of education and a lot of seminars. But the question that I always got from people was, what level are you? As in, like, what level sommelier are you?
Oh.
Why are you here teaching me about wine? What do you know, and how do I know that you know what you know?
So smarter like, people than I were going
I
to the station.
Go.
Then.
Yeah. So I guess I gotta go get some sort of certification for all of this. Mm. So I did it really quickly and just like boom, bam.
Wait a minute. What does quickly mean?
Well, luckily, I had 10 years under my belt already of studying wine and showing wine and learning about wine so that I could tell someone else about it. I didn't have to spend as much time as most people would ramming and studying for the exam. I had already tasted a lot of wines from all over the world. I already had a lot of exposure. And so going to the certified level wasn't as difficult for me as it might have been for other people. Of course, after that, that's when it starts getting very difficult when you go to advanced and master. And so,
what level are you?
I'm level two. I'm a certified sommelier. I went through my advanced courses and I stopped at the before taking the exam because that's when it starts getting very expensive.
Oh.
And I just didn't see the reasoning
didn't
at that point
the payoff
in time. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The professional payoff wasn't really going to be there for me. So.
So in addition to teaching classes, maybe like you do here at the Wine Sneak, what else do you do as a sommelier?
So now I used to have like five jobs, just working for different importers and buying for different places.
Oh, okay.
Now I just work for one importer called Martine's Wines, and primarily a French importer, but we have wines from all over the world. And I sell wine and I just drive all over California with a bag of wine in my car and meet with people and talk about wine.
Again, I'm speaking with Jenna Congdon, who's a local sommelier who deals primarily with imports. And one of the reasons I asked her to be with us to teach us about some wine pairings we might do around Thanksgiving was because she could talk to us a little bit about some of the old world wines. So I'm glad you're with us. My first question has got to be, why do people always say you sip wine? Because I don't. I drink wine.
You
I take
wine.
A mouthful of wine. I don't sip it with my pinky up.
Do you know, my pinky naturally goes up.
Well, you were raised in a very formal background.
It's really kind of creepy. That's a very good question. I think some people drink wine, but I think wine versus other beverages, there are so many subtleties to the wine that if you're drinking it quickly, then you tend to miss those subtleties. And if you let it kind of go over your entire palate, which happens when you sip rather than drinking, if you're doing it slowly, then it hits those little parts of your tongue. When we were in kindergarten or whatever, we talked about the different parts of the tongue where certain things taste differently. And so you really want it to kind of coat your entire mouth. You want a little oxygen to get in. You sometimes, if someone's sipping, mm-hmm. you can hear them slurping some air in, especially if they're in the industry, while they're sipping. And you're basically aerating the wine while it's in your mouth. Mm-hmm. It sounds a little strange while doing it. I'll do it a little later for you.
Well, my mom and my grandma would be rolling in their grave.
Yeah.
Let's talk about another word I would like to define, terroir. T-E-R-R-O-I-R.
Yes.
French, obviously.
Yes, yes. Not terrier.
But no,
terroir. Yeah, so this is a kind of a difficult one to define because it's so many things. And that's one of the things that makes wine so singular as an agricultural product, is that all of these different aspects of not only a vineyard, but also the cellar in which the wine is aged can also be part of the terroir. So really, when we talk about terroir, we talk about earth, whatever soils the vines are planted in. We talk about aspect of the slope, whether it's west-facing or east-facing. We're talking about the weather, the climate. So we have here a Mediterranean climate. And then in Burgundy, they have a continental climate. So they're different climates.
Why did you choose Burgundy?
Only because we have two wines in front of me, so I keep looking at them because I want to drink them. One is Pinot Noir from Burgundy in France, and one is a Pinot Noir from Santa Maria Valley here in California.
Okay, because that's an important thing too. I want to talk about the French roots, quote unquote, if you will. So the terroir is going to be different in Santa Maria, not just in Burgundy, but also in Paso Robles, right?
Yes, very. Yeah. We are really lucky here in a lot of ways, because in a 30-minute drive, we can taste so many different styles of wines, because there are so many climatic differences here that really change how a grape can grow. And because of these different pockets and different, what do you call them, subclimates or microclimates, right? You have all these different microclimates where certain grapes grow better than others. It took us a while to figure out what grows well where. Burgundy and France, they had thousands of years to figure this out. We've really only been doing it for 100, you know, or less here on the Central Coast.
We're not as hot here south of the Grade. We've got Chardonnays, Sauvignon Blancs, perhaps. I don't know what else, but our Pinots are different. Even the Pinot itself is different than it is up in Paso.
Yeah, Pinot Noir is really temperamental. It's a thin-skinned grape. It likes cooler climates. You can grow these things really anywhere if you want to. But if you want to make very good Pinot Noir, then you choose specific places for their terroir. And cooler climates is really important for a really fantastic Pinot Noir.
Then why do they grow it over the Grade?
I don't know. You didn't hear that from me. You didn't hear that from me.
Oh, that looks beautiful. I'm going to pour this other one. Look at the difference in the color on that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Between the... This is the domestic, the one from Scar of the Sea, Vino de los Ranchos in Santa Maria. This is a 2019 Pinot. This is a 2017, the French one. That's interesting. We'll talk about years, too.
Yep. That's another part of that. Other things that affect a wine will be the vintage as well, on top of all that terroir that we just discussed.
This is Betsy Nash, the Grape Nut on Issues and Ideas for KCBX Public Radio. My guest today is Jenna Congdon, and we're talking about wines on the Central Coast as usual, but I'm also getting some terms defined, which I really appreciate. We've just been talking a little bit about the difference in terroir of the above the Grade and below the Grade here in San Luis County, and how Pinot Noir is grown both places.
It is, yeah.
And it's going to be a bit of a different wine.
Very much so, very much so. I mean, the one thing to note also is the Pinot Noir vineyards, primarily in Paso Robles, are all on the west side in the Templeton Gap area.
And that means it's cooler weather.
Cooler weather, yeah, because it's pulling in that fog. Mm-hmm. It's closer to the coast.
Yes.
And they have just that natural, what's called the Templeton Gap, that honestly just like pulls that marine layer right in and cools it off.
And so that's why in Paso Robles we have that big diurnal shift. We have the very hot days, but then we have those cooler nights. And that's really what makes it a great grape growing area to retain some of that acidity. You could still make great Pinot Noir in Paso Robles. So it's really just a matter of taste.
And the winemaker needs to do whatever adjusting is necessary, no matter where a grape is grown.
We'll have warm harvests down here in our quote-unquote cool climate San Luis Obispo. Also, we've had some days that have been over 100 this past year and the year before, so our cool climate is really starting to heat up.
And it'll be interesting to see, will it get cooler down here and hotter up there, or will it get hotter both places?
I'm not really sure.
All right, Jenna, I want to read a description of wine. We were talked about having our pinkies up and how wine is supposed to be this big elevated thing. Well, I think years ago, when it went from jugs from Pacenti to 300 or however many wineries we have here, people talked about it being a snobby thing. It doesn't feel snobby to me anymore, but it definitely feels like I want to be more educated about it. So here is a description, and you tell me if this is snobby or educated.
Okay.
And maybe you should guess what wine it is. A velvety smooth wine with soft cheer. I don't need to read it that way, sorry.
Yes, you do. It's so much better when you read it that way.
All right. A velvety smooth wine with soft cherry aromas and barrel aged for a full 12 months in medium toast French oak. The palate is rich and full with a wonderful balance of lingering fruit, elements of vanilla and smoky flavors with light tannins. This old wine, premium fruit harvested from the Santa Maria Valley, has a wonderful characteristic of spicy pepper on the finish.
Well, if I was going to guess, I'm a little thrown off. You know, when Santa Maria Valley came in, I was like, maybe it's Pinot Noir. But then, and a velvety wine is also sometimes Pinot Noir. And if it sees some oak, then it has tannin. But then there was that black pepper, which brought me to Syrah.
Me too. That's like one thing I know about wines. Pepper, Syrah.
Yeah.
But it is, in fact, a 2018 Pinot. Alape.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
So
we got some words in here.
Okay.
Velvety smooth, I get that. Okay. Now, is that the mouthfeel, which
That's
is another
the
word?
The mouthfeel, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which I guess is self-descriptive. All right, and barrel-aged, medium toast.
Medium
what
toast.
What the heck is that?
So a cooper who makes the barrels, they can choose how much toast they want, which is basically how much they burn the inside of the wood. The higher toast, the more flavor you're imparting in the wine. So if you use a very light toast, then you're not going for that big oaky vanilla flavor. You're using that a little more as a vessel rather than something to impart a lot of flavor. And that's the same thing when we talk about neutral oak barrels.
Which means?
It means old oak. It's basically like 3 or 4 or 5 years old. They've used it for that many harvests. And so it's no longer imparting any sort of flavor components into the wine from the oak.
So neutral meaning flavorless.
Flavorless, yeah,
for lack of a better term.
Exactly, so that's becoming just a vessel, basically, to hold the wine.
Like a stainless would be, or a concrete?
Yes, but each of those has a little different reason for it. I mean, because you use, if with stainless, there's no oxygen getting in whatsoever. There's no porosity of the vessel, right? So it's going to stay a little more hard-edged, right? It's not going to soften. There's not going to be any oxidation to that wine at all. If you're using an oak barrel, there's, because of the shape of the barrel, and then also because of the porosity of oak, you are going to have some evaporation and you're going to have some oxidation.
Okay.
And that'll soften the wine a little bit. And then if you're using concrete, even just the concrete itself imparting a little bit of a flavor component to the wine, but you also have some porosity there. So there is some oxygen transfer.
Fascinating. And it would matter which of those vessels you use depending on the grape. And depending on what you wanted it to turn out to be.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. You can. People talk about their barrels and their barrel program as basically the spice rack of winemaking.
Oh, okay.
Because you can use different toasts, as we just discussed.
Right.
And that will also impart not just
flavor, but it'll also impart mouthfeel because you'll have more tannin with a higher toast barrel and more time in the barrel. You can use French oak, which they mentioned here, versus American oak. Those both impart different flavor components also.
Man. All right. Thinking of a Chardonnay, when I think of oaky or oak,
yeah.
Would they toast the oak to make an oaky Chardonnay?
Yes. Again, we have so many wonderful Chardonnays here that don't see a lot of new oak. And I think Chardonnay gets a little bit of a bad rep. We just love our new barrels here. But there are more and more people making Chardonnay in a less opulent style, in a much more food-friendly style. It shows more minerality and some more kind of nervous tension, more acidity, and less of that big, rich oakiness.
All right, so I heard nervous tension, which is a fascinating word to use when describing it, but I get the acidity part now. I get that. And having tasted some big, oaky Chardonnays, I know what you're talking about. Smooth and rich.
Yeah,
and
not a lot of acidity there.
Definitely can stand on their own. And the other would be then more food friendly, as you said.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. This is Betsy Nash, the Grape Nut on Issues and Ideas for KCBX Public Radio. My guest today is Jenna Congdon, and we're talking about wines on the Central Coast as usual. But I'm also getting some terms defined. Another word in here is the palate is rich and full with wonderful balance of lingering fruit, blah, 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 blah. I have a palate. Wine doesn't have a palate. Can you explain that one?
I used to write tasting notes, by the way, back in the day. So when we talk about tasting notes and we break them down, when you read a tasting note, it usually starts with the nose.
Okay.
So when they say the nose gives aromas of blah, 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 blah,
the
basically
smell.
Like what you're smelling.
Okay.
But it's not as poetic to say you're going to smell this, that, and the other. Is you got to say the nose carries hints of black licorice and blah, blah, blah. So you have the nose, you have the mouthfeel.
Okay.
That's that velvety blah, blah, blah. You have the palate, which is really just what you're tasting.
Okay, so it's the tongue.
Yeah,
well,
it tastes like
the air
this.
And the, okay.
They're not going to say, they're not going to say it tastes like blah, blah, blah. They're trying to find great ways to say it tastes like this.
Okay.
And then you're going to have the finish. There's usually something about the finish, whether it's a good amount of tannins on the finish or a lot of minerality or acidity on the finish. It'll give you some sort of idea of what your mouth is left with after you swallow the wine.
Well put. Another word I want us to talk about is flavonoids. When I've talked to others about how can you say there's strawberry flavor in Pinot or boysenberries or whatever it's going to be. No, that's black fruit. That would be more like a cab.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, sometimes. It depends on where it's grown. You can have black fruits and Pinot Noir, too.
You know what? That's why wine is a lot like HR. The first thing you say is, it depends.
It depends.
Anytime you're asked a question, oh, it depends. So when you identify a flavor or an aroma and stuff, we know strawberries were not thrown in with the Pinot Noir grapes. Right.
Right.
And so...
Well, you and I know that.
Oh.
But
well, maybe
other
Boone's
people don't.
Farm.
I mean, I have tasted with people before, and they're like... asking me quietly as if it's a stupid question, was there actually fruit put in this wine? Was there actually, and these are people that I, you know, would drink wine with on a regular basis.
Uh-huh.
So it's not surprising.
Well, I appreciate
with the way
it.
That they describe wine, sometimes it can be very confusing. Like, do they actually put the black pepper and leather, and how do they get the smoke in there?
And leave the gasoline out.
Yeah, right. I don't want any petrol in my wine.
Right. All right. So so then it's a legitimate question.
Absolutely.
And is that the flavonoids?
Those are, and they can come from different things depending on the grape. We talk about pyrazines. Pyrazines bring a character of green bell pepper and grassiness. To a wine.
And a pyrazine is some chemical?
It's some chemical
compound.
Or a
mineral or something?
It's a chemical compound.
Okay, okay.
And it's found in Sauvignon Blanc, in Cabernet Sauvignon, in Cabernet Franc. Primarily, when you can find them most often is in those three grapes.
Okay.
It stands out. The black pepper is a rotundin. And that's a different type of flavonoid, a different type of chemical compound.
Okay.
And then we have, our malolactic compounds, which...
for Chardonnay come off as butter and cream. So, or really, I mean, that's when we know malolactic, or we talk about malolactic the most often. It's a secondary fermentation. It's a process that turns malic acid into lactic acid. And a byproduct of that reaction is diacetyl, which gives you, that is the another byproduct that we have in like movie butter popcorn.
Oh, which isn't really butter, right?
Right. It probably has some diacetyl in it.
Okay.
So that's why we get those buttery or, you know, lactic parts of the Chardonnay that we come up with, the oaky buttery. That's the buttery part.
Are these things coming from the minerals in the soil, or are they coming from the grapes?
They're coming from the grapes, but depending on how much they impart that flavor component into a wine, will be partly the soil, partly the temperature, partly the climate. That will be the terroir.
Okay.
So, you know, how peppery a Syrah is.
And you can't tell that when you just take a bite of the grape, right?
No. Yeah. You're not going to get, you're not going to taste a Syrah grape off the vine and say, wow, this is peppery.
It just comes through the fermentation process.
Yep.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
That is amazing.
And that's why we sip our wine.
Quit coming back to that.
This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. You've been listening to a conversation with Betsy Nash, the Grape Nut, and local sommelier Jenna Congdon. Next week on Issues and Ideas, they'll continue their conversation, comparing imported with local wines and food pairings for Thanksgiving. Orchestra Novo is a local orchestra led by artistic director Michael Novak, whose mission is to inspire, nurture, and transform. This Saturday, Orchestra Novo is presenting their opening night called Something Old, Something New, featuring both classical and modern works. KCBX's Benjamin Perper spoke with Novak and local musician Inga Swearingen, who will be presenting her songs accompanied by Orchestra Novo this Saturday. The interview begins with an in-studio original song from Swearingen.
Inga Swearingen and Michael Novak, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate this. This has been great to have somebody, two people in the studio safely. This is great. So, Inga, can you start by introducing yourself for me, please?
Oh, sure. I have grown up here in the area, and I teach at Cuesta College, and just love being a part of this community of San Luis Obispo. Yeah.
And Michael?
I'm Michael Novak, and I came to San Luis Obispo in 1984, and I just couldn't leave. It's just too good a place in so many ways.
Absolutely. So let's talk about Saturday, November 20th, Something Old, Something New. Michael, we can start with you. What's the program like? What's on the docket?
Well, thanks for asking, Ben. This will be our season opener after a year and a half being shut down, and really our voices closed for all that time, our musical voices, not just singing voices, but violin voices and woodwind voices. And so it's very, very exciting for us to finally get back together. It's just been so darn long. That year and a half has just been so difficult for all of us, all musicians everywhere, because our job is to be out in the world performing and sharing our love and, you know, what we do so well and want to do. It's our heart and our soul and our inspiration, and we need to pass it on to our friends and get that word out.
Absolutely.
So it's exciting for us that we found a date, November 20th, thanks to Tom Davies. Thank you, Tom Davies, for vacating that date. It was originally going to be a Master Chorale concert that evening at in Cal Poly, but Tom's singers weren't quite up to the timing of it. He'll be back in December doing a holiday program. But we were very happy to get that date, and we're going to be at Cuesta College at the Performing Arts Center, which is Inga's home and home to some of our other players, and including Dave Becker, our saxophonist and arranger, who's extraordinary. And so I thought what we'd do on this program would be bring a little bit of what Orchestra Novo does anyway, and that's kind of cross genres, musical time zones. We're not just fixed in the Baroque period or the Romantic period, but let's add some contemporary stuff to it, more modern, jazzy and contemporary feel. Let's make believe we're in a classic. Craig Russell's over at Cal Poly, and he's talking about the music of the 60s, and he's talking about the 1860s and the 1960s too. So we've got music of Sibelius, Jan Sibelius, the great Finnish composer, and then the wonderful Unfinished Symphony by Franz Schubert. That'll be the first half, and then second half, Inga Swearingen and Friends.
An April afternoon, the wind is carrying a tune. The grass on the hillside is rippling like the waters of the sea.
So, Michael, you mentioned coming back after COVID, not that COVID's over, but having your first show after not being able to perform for a year and a half, right?
Yeah.
So, Inga, what is that like for you? What's this process been like to come back out into the world?
Yeah. I hope I remember how to do it. I'm so excited. I've dipped my toe back into it, but I haven't really done much performing at all. So, but people have asked, you know, gosh, what have you been doing? And I've sing every day around the house, so I'm making music, but sharing it is something that's really been missing, and that's such a beautiful part of the whole part of being a musician, is to work really hard on something and then share it with all the other musicians and the audience, and just that important coming together. So I've really missed it, and I'm so excited to do it. Yeah.
I happen to see, I don't know if you folks have seen it too, but there was a, when the Chicago Symphony opened their season this year, I think they did a concert with strings only. But their conductor, Ricardo Muti, got in front of the audience and explained how important music is to people, that it's not just something, entertainment. It goes deep into the soul, into the heart of human beings. It's essential to our life. So all that time without it, we were all losing something of our lives. We weren't able to... I mean, we listened on radios and, you know, YouTubes and things like that, but to actually be in the room or to be on stage, to share that with each other, communication, special communication, that's why they always say music is a language, because it really is a language between human beings, whether it's verbal or nonverbal, there's this sense of connecting us.
For sure. So this last weekend, we did the Cuesta Vocal Jazz Festival, and these are 18-year-olds. They're high school and some college, and we had a little Q&A session, and their questions were not like, what scale do you use when you're, or what do you practice, or how do you make it in the music business? Nothing like that. It was, what kept you going over this last 18 months? Would you keep anything from what you learned moving forward? And why didn't you give up on music when you couldn't make it, like, together, and you couldn't perform? And, you know, it's already so challenging to sell your music out there. So why didn't you give up on music? Those were the like, three main questions that took a half an hour for all of us to answer and talk about. You know, we were so struck by the depth of how difficult this year has been for people that are express or get something from music and the arts, how difficult this has been. And it was just what you were saying, just that connecting piece was so missed. So we're so excited to come together in the same room, and we don't take it for granted.
So what about the unfinished business part of this?
Unfinished business, yeah.
Yeah, what is that theme about?
Unfinished business. Franz Schubert wrote Symphony No. 8, and he wrote two movements. And normally, he would write four movements, and he didn't. Or, well, he may have written some other movements that didn't get included into this mix to finish it off, but... I've looked online a lot about this, and there are so many theories about why he didn't finish it. One is that he had finished two really great movements, and it stands by itself that way. It's 25 minutes just by itself, so which is almost as long as a lot of symphonies of that period have been. Haydn symphonies, Mozart symphonies, the entire piece would be about a half an hour, and now he's got two movements that are 25 minutes. Symphony No. 9, which followed shortly after, is close to an hour long. I mean, it's lengthy. Schubert's music is lengthy. So there are some people that say after two movements he wasn't inspired enough to finish it. Other people say he was working on so many projects at once that he just kind of lost its place. The piece lost its place and he just went on. And I was reading up on Schubert and found out that this was one guy that's just spent all day and all night composing. This was like his mission in life. Wake up, whatever, he had a cup of something, and then go. And there's a quote that I read that said, I work and I work and I write and I write, and when that one piece is finished, I just start another one. So this music was just coming to him left and right all the time. I mean, we see this with the great masters continually, people like Bach and Mozart and Beethoven. Music was just flowing. Inga, she writes her own music. Anytime you're a composer, it comes and comes and it doesn't stop. I mean, it's just a flow of activity that's just brain function and heart function, and it's another part of the universe that we love to tap into. I think it's, I always call it being plugged in, because it's an energy and electricity in a way, you know, and you find the source and you just do it. And so the answer to it is it works really well as the Unfinished Symphony, and it became famous as the Unfinished Symphony. So other people have tried to finish it. There are sketches of Schubert that they say, that was probably going to be the third movement, or that would have been the fourth movement. Or some other people say, well, maybe that third movement ended up in another piece, that it didn't really fit in this piece, but he kept it and used it over here. So there's no one specific answer.
Going back to you, Inga, so you are, like Michael said, your songs are original, but you're going to be doing them with orchestration, right? Or some kind of arrangement.
Yeah.
So how did that process come about? Who did the arranging?
So it's thrilling to hear something that you wrote on, you know, for guitar and voice to be filled out into full orchestra. And Dave Becker has done three of the arrangements, and Blackbird was done by
Brad Dechter from LA.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And
we have one new one from Dave coming as well.
Yeah, we do, Indian Summer. So mm-hmm. So all our originals, except for, of course, for Blackbird, but it's so twisted into almost unrecognizable as being the Beatles, but it's just amazing to hear it recognized and written out for strings and wind instruments, and it's amazing. It's really fun.
Right. So you write it on the resonator guitar, which we have in the studio here. Mm. And then you have all these other instruments. That must be really, really cool, right?
It's amazing. So it comes in all ways. Sometimes with just voice and I play with a looper sometimes. So I get a lot of ideas just by improvising around with that and guitar. It comes in different forms. But yes, to hear it filled out into a fuller form is exciting. Mm-hmm.
And Michael, this new Musical Horizons bit, can you talk about that? What does that mean? What are you exploring here?
Well, I think this is where Inga shines more than anybody I've ever met, and that's her ability to improvise. And so New Horizons means it's sort of like the New Horizon, you know, explorer out into space. We don't know where we're going. We talk about this. We've done some children's shows together called Fly Me to the Moon. And when we improvise, or not so much me, because I'm more classically trained, but when folks improvise, there's a structure, there's a chord structure. So we know we're inside some kind of spaceship. We're moving out there into the Netherlands. But we're not sure where we're going. And we're not sure where our trip will take us. And that's the new horizon that I see. It's sort of every moment is created. And that's the exciting part for me, coming from the old school. So I say something old. I'm old. And the music I have studied is old. And that's the traditional music. And then we have the new, which is Inga's music that she's writing today, yesterday, and the ability to improvise on top of it. So that's all part of the new horizon. So something old, something new. I wanted to, we'll talk about the Sibelius in a minute because there's a really great story about that. But Jan Sibelius, this Finnish composer, he lived to be 90 years old, maybe even slightly older. And it was pretty much a bald guy. So even when he was fairly young, he still looked old. But when he was old, he looked really old. And I wanted to put for our promotional picture a picture of, like, Jan Sibelius and then a picture of, like, Inga as a baby. So we have something old and something new. I'm sure your folks could find something for me.
I'm sure.
It's not too late. Okay, so what about this Sibelius piece that we're talking about here?
Right. We're going to open the concert with a piece by Jan Sibelius. Everybody knows him from Finlandia. He was Finland's greatest composer. Rich composer, I mean, wonderful pieces of music. Violin concertos, one of the great violin concertos. Some of his symphonies are just so beautiful and lush and romantic. And he wrote this piece, Andante Festivo, which we will open the concert because in a way it's a festive occasion for us. This piece was originally written for a string quartet, and it was commissioned by the people of a small town in Finland who were celebrating the 25th anniversary of the local sawmill. This sawmill was created so they could take the trees from the forest and make boards out of them And the boards became the town. They made the houses, they made the buildings, they made the shops. And it was all thanks to the sawmill. So it's kind of dedicated to this inanimate kind of thing that gave life to the whole town. So, of course, they, you know, the town leaders will say, well, we've got to have an anthem. We need a tune. So let's get Jan to do it. I don't know how many other Finnish composers are running around, but that's the guy we want. And it actually happened. I hope it was happening not in the winter, but it might have been a little cold. But ultimately, years later, Sibelius created a score for just strings. So he augmented it from string quartet to a bigger sound. So he added the string bass part. And I'm going to experiment a little bit during rehearsals and see if we can add some other players from the orchestra in there to just kind of make it a bigger sound to open up. I'm not sure it will be as good as what Sibelius wrote, but it'll be... I take artistic liberty with this. I don't usually monkey with composers' notes because I revere them for what they wrote and the time they put into it and the thought they put into it. But I've worked enough in Hollywood to know that, hey, everything's up for grabs. So my work with arrangers and composers in the studios down south has taught me a lot about how to approach music. In a different way that I used to when I was just a regular classical music student and continue to be. And that's that everything's not final. If Schubert were sitting next to me or Sibelius was sitting next to me and I offered a suggestion, he might say, let's try that. Not a bad idea. Yeah. And that's where I've learned in my life that you can think outside the box a little bit. We don't have to be really squished into one way of doing things. So we'll give it a try, and if it doesn't sound great, then we'll just go back and do it the way he wanted to, and that's glorious too.
Right.
But I love the story about the piece, and you know what I like a lot about it? It's a wonderful piece of music. It's beautiful. It sings. It's got a warmth about it that you wouldn't normally say Scandinavian music is warm, but this is warm.
So let's talk about the particulars of the concert then. What time is it? How can people get involved or find out more about it?
Right. Our concert, Orchestra Novo opening night, Something Old, Something New, is November 20th, Saturday night, 7:30 p.m. at the Cuesta Performing Arts Center. Tickets are $30 for general seating. Student tickets are $10, and they'll be available at the door. If you want to reserve tickets ahead, which I really recommend you shall or should, go to our website, orchestranovo.org, all one word, .org, and when you look up upcoming events or concerts, you should be able to have a thread that'll take you right to purchasing tickets.
All right. Great. Anything else you want to say before we close?
Just how thrilled I am to get to play with Orchestra Novo. Thank you so much, Michael. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. What a way to start the year.
Yes.
I'm so happy about it and excited to have you with us. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
All right. Inga Swearingen and Michael Novak, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
It was fun. Thank
you. Nice to meet you. Thanks a lot.
A true love of mine.
Listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.